The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Margaret Kimberly discusses the dismissal of Comey, the character of Trump, and how the left needs to break with the DNC. She's a regular columnist from the Black Agenda Report and also a regular guest on this podcast. It's Wednesday, June 14th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Thanks goes out to Zero Books Club members. And we encourage you to join. Zero Books Club members gain access to a second podcast each week. The Inside Zero Books podcast sometimes features a second hour from this podcast, and sometimes features conversations about the left and left publishing with members of the Zero Books editorial team. It's Trump's birthday, so the music you're listening to right now is a jazzy piano arrangement of Happy Birthday by Johnny May. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Margaret Kimberly and I discuss the dismissal of Comey and the incompetence of Trump. Margaret Kimberly is a senior columnist at the Black Agenda Report and a regular and longtime guest on this podcast. Her own blog is called Freedom Writer. And you should check that out. I'll put a link in the show notes, but I'm really glad to welcome Margaret Kimberly back to the podcast.
Hi, Doug. Thank you so much for having me back.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to start by offering my condolences to you. I understand that you're very upset to see such a fine man as James Comey be treated so shabbily, and that you're very worried about the morale of the FBI after this atrocity.
Well, you know,
Hillary Clinton gave an interview and said it was Comey's fault that she lost because he talked about the investigation of her use of a private email server while she was Secretary of State. And this happened late in October. And she said if the election had taken place on October 27th, I'm not sure of the exact date, but I would have been president. So, liberals hated Comey that week. The following week, Trump fires him. And all of a sudden, there's this outpouring of sympathy for him and concern about the status, the state of the FBI itself. And this has been going on a while. Trump has just turned everything on its head. And people who, I'll just say it, who should know better, are they're attacking Trump from the right. If you're going to say that the FBI and the CIA and the NSA, and they were saying 17 intelligence agencies. I didn't know we had 17. But anyway, 17 intelligence agencies believe there was some sort of Russian influence over Trump's campaign. I have never trusted any of those entities. And this invention of the term the intelligence community, I don't recall any of these agencies being referred to as a community. And I think this choice of word is deliberate to make them sound warm and fuzzy. We always spoke of intelligence agencies and agents or officers or so forth. So this has been going on during last year's campaign and intensified after the election. And I never quoted the FBI or the CIA, and I'm not going to start now. These are, talk about the deep state. I mean, my goodness, the FBI, their COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, which existed for, officially existed for decades. I'm convinced that it still does, which had people under surveillance, who had everybody during the Black Liberation Struggle, and Martin Luther King, everybody, not just King, King most famously. And they wrote him a letter saying he should kill himself. And he was, they tried to smear him. They crushed the Black Panther Party. They instigated rivalries, got people to kill each other. In some cases, they did the killing themselves. So for people who tend to have progressive politics to suddenly start defending the FBI is pretty strange to me. And Comey himself, these, look, anybody who gets to be FBI director is no friend of mine. I mean, you don't get that job by upholding human rights and progressive values. Comey said there was no such thing as mass incarceration, and he didn't like the term. I mean, this in this country where we have more people in prison than any other, he's one of those who spoke of the so-called Ferguson effect, discrediting the protest over police killings and claiming that there were crime increases in crime rates in some cities. And it's because the police were so afraid and they, you know, afraid to do their job. So this is not somebody I'm going to defend. I mean, it is problematic. The president has the right to fire the FBI director. It should be, I think, for a clear reason. And with Trump, you never know. You know, one day he says one thing, once a day he says another. But I'm not concerned about the apparatus of the state being impacted by the departure of this particular individual. So so that's where I stand in my my last column. No tears for the FBI, I believe is what I call it.
You know, watching Trump on TV, you almost get the impression that he's more of a reality TV star than he is of a president. Oh, wait a minute.
But he is.
That's right. Yeah, no, it's, look, I'm with you. I mean, I'm no fan of James Comey. I didn't like him during the election. I didn't dislike him that much either. I mean, like when he came out and said what he said about Hillary Clinton the first time, I thought he had overstepped his bounds, that he shouldn't have, if he wasn't going to indict her.
Right.
He shouldn't say more than that to give us his personal opinion about the matter seemed like a gross abuse of power. And that's actually the reason Trump gave for firing him originally. And I sort of can see that, but that, because I can imagine myself like being investigated for something and having the officer who was investigating my case come out and say terrible things about me without arresting me. And that would be like a total violation of my rights, right? So
yeah.
I could completely understand people who wanted to support Clinton on that. I think that was right. But at the same time, it sounded like he maybe should have indicted her, that she had done enough wrong.
He was inconsistent. I think Comey was trying to protect himself. I think he, like most other people, thought she was going to win. But I think he was afraid that this issue was going to come up again and he could be hurt if he had not gone on record to say something. So, but then he tried to have it both ways. So he said that there was a concern, but then ultimately he said, well, there's no cause for an indictment, but that's not up to him to decide. But he also said, but if, you know, so there wasn't going to be any attempt at a prosecution. But then he said, but if anybody else did this, they'd be prosecuted. Well, you know, it's either something you should try to prosecute.
Then you should prosecute them. Don't, you know. Yeah.
Exactly. So yeah. I happen to think it was, I'm not a lawyer, but it was a terrible conflict of interest for her. And that's one of Hillary Clinton's weaknesses. That's one of the reasons I think she lost. One of her flaws, she was still doing the business of the Clinton Foundation, and that's why she was trying to hide her email. So the Secretary of State I mean, does the State Department have an IT guy? I mean, I'm sorry. Why wouldn't the Secretary of State? And then they tried to push Colin Powell under the bus. I don't know if you remember that little episode where she or people, other people defending her said, well, Colin Powell did the same thing. And he did not. It was not anywhere near the same thing. But at any rate, yeah, so Comey, you know, can be criticized for that. And, you know, Trump, I think there has to be a clear, convincing reason to fire the director of the FBI person. And I care more about the role that the FBI and other law enforcement play in our lives.
Have you ever watched soap operas?
My goodness, decades ago.
Yeah. Well, I feel like this is what we're a couple of fans of a soap opera and we're just talking about it because it's such a stupid mess, you know? Oh, Comey was terrible, but Clinton and then Colin Powell, well, you know, he definitely did her wrong. And it's like, okay, wait a minute. This is supposed to be politics. But, I agree with you about, you know, how they tried to throw Powell under the bus. And Clinton clearly was covering up her shenanigans with the Clinton Foundation. I don't know how deep those went, but... Mm-hmm. But these people they're silly. And speaking of that, how do you feel about the fact that former communists are running our government through a Manchurian candidate that they installed into the White House using super hackers and fake news?
Talk about a soap opera. I mean, it does sound like a plot of a movie. I think a couple of things. I think Trump's people like Flynn, I think Flynn was just a crook. He was just taking money from a lot of people. He was just on the take. There are a lot of rich Russians. And so he was also lobbying in Turkey. And, you know, he was on the take to make money. And as far as Trump is concerned, I don't see the proof of Russian involvement in the campaign. We don't know who hacked the DNC. We don't know if it was hacked. We don't know if there was a whistleblower leaking. If there was a hack, I think it might have just been Trump himself and some of his associates, Roger Stone and Nigel Farage. Nigel Farage mysteriously visited Julian Assange, who doesn't have to worry about a rape case anymore, but may not still be able to leave England or leave the Ecuadorian embassy. But anyway, a couple of months ago, Nigel Farage, the leader of the UKIP party, the man who led the Brexit effort, visited Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy. And now the WikiLeaks did the leaking, but we don't know who gave it to them. I just thought that was rather odd. And Farage is connected with Trump through this billionaire Robert Mercer, who essentially bailed out Trump's campaign, which was floundering. Their connections with Breitbart and Farage. So I wonder if people are barking up the wrong conspiracy tree, but nobody has looked into that. When everyone talks about a hack, it's about whether the Russians did it. Well, my question is, maybe somebody else did it. So, but in the absence of any investigation, that's speculation on my part. And I think a lot of the attacks on Trump because of his, you know, and his connections with Russians, it's very interesting. Part of the problem is he's being hoisted on his own petard because there was a point when he bragged about doing deals in Russia. Well, he didn't do any deals in Russia. They let him host a beauty contest and they sent him home empty-handed. He didn't buy anything, sell anything, build anything. Then a Putin lookalike showed up at Trump Tower and fooled Trump, who thought Putin had come to visit him. And, you know, on the other hand, Bill Clinton actually did deals in Russia, that uranium deal, and met Putin and got paid $500,000 to give a speech. What an irony. So, I'm not convinced of it, and I find this this generalized Russophobia now to be very dangerous. Putin has been demonized so much; it's hard to even. I don't recall any leader, even during the days of the Soviet Union, during the Cold War. I do not recall any leader in the world being vilified to that extent, or the media colluding to hide America's wrongdoing around the world. So that's the easiest way to get somebody is to use Putin as your foil. So now, so this story, and I think it's a non-story, frankly. The Russian foreign minister met with Trump and the Secretary of State last. And first, there was this ridiculous story about they had a photographer and the photographer could have planted a bug. And why did they let any Russians in? I mean, it's just stupid for the Russian foreign minister not to have a photographer with him. It's just ridiculous. And presumably the White House has security sweeps. So if he left, is there some Russian bug that nobody else in the world knows about? I mean, it was ridiculous from the very beginning. And then this story broke this week where Trump allegedly gave some secret to Lavrov, the foreign minister. And, and Washington Post broke this, what I think is a non-story, claiming he gave him information that compromised an ally, and which turned out to be Israel, which I suspected all along. So I was wondering, I was like, well, what is he alleged to have told him? Did he give him the name of CIA agents? I mean, anyway, it's about there were ISIS plots to bring down airplanes. And so this is not really a new story. This has been discussed for the past couple of weeks. And there was such concern that there was a proposal to laptops from transatlantic flights to the United States. So he apparently discussed this with Lavrov. He didn't give him any codes or give him anybody's name. They made up, I believe it's made up, some rule I'd never heard of. You can't tell country B that something country A told you unless you get country A's permission before you tell country B. I'm sure at this level they all talk about the intelligence that they gather. Without mentioning any names or specifics, but it tells you the extent to which there are certain forces that want to get rid of Trump. I don't know if they want to impeach him. I think the Democrats would rather keep him around and run against him, which I think is a mistake. That's one of the reasons that Hillary Clinton lost. They thought it was enough to talk about how horrible Trump was. But it's very interesting moment for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting to me to see people backpedal around Trump as it looks like he might actually fall apart and get impeached. Because the thing about Trump is he's really, like I said, he doesn't know that he's president in some fundamental level. He still is playing this sort of reality TV game where he can just wing it, and if he says things with conviction and is relatively charismatic when he does it, he figures that's going to fly. Like, so he gets on with Lester Holt and says just whatever comes into his head, I guess.
And apparently the rest of his staff is like that too.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like, he confesses to obstructing justice for no reason. I mean, it wasn't like Lester Holt was you know, doing gotcha journalism there and tricked him into something. He just asked him, you know, why did you let James Comey go? And Trump's off like, oh, yeah, it's all me. I decided and all this. And it was because of this Russia thing is a fake news. So I just figured we should probably end that and get rid of James Comey. And it's like, you can't do that and escape impeachment. But really now it seems like no one wants him to go exactly. And I'm hearing a lot of people who are pretty run-of-the-mill Democrats say things like, oh, my God, what about, President Pence? That will be much, much worse. And I was like, well, can we stop shaking our boots for a minute here? Go ahead.
Well, I think what would happen is, Trump is you have to admit that on some level, Trump is fun. It's like he'll blurt out that the job is harder than he thought. I mean, really? It's like, I'm sure he's not the first president to say, oh my God, did I really want this job? But he's the only one who would say it.
I bet you Obama said
I'm sure he did.
Senator who kind of fell into the presidency. I mean, he wasn't supposed mm-hmm. to be the guy. And so I'm sure he had a moment or two where he went, what am I doing here? But anyway, go on.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he never would have said
no,
it. Nobody else would have said that except Trump, who's just like, he's just himself. He's like, I had a good life. Life was good. Well, I don't know why I wanted to do this. And he's unprepared. He's probably the, you know, it's a funny thing. He doesn't know he's not ready. I always had the feeling that George W. Bush knew his limitations. Mm-hmm. I always had the feeling he knew he wasn't up to it. Mm-hmm. He didn't like to work hard. And he was glad to say, I'm going to let Dick Cheney run this. And being from the Republican establishment, they got, you know, people in who knew their jobs to help walk him through it. But Trump thinks he knows when he doesn't know. And he's happy to have other incompetent people around him. I mean, this Sean Spicer, it's like, my God, if someone asked him a question about Spicer and he just blurts out, he says, well, you know, he gets good ratings. And it's like you have the worst, yeah, most incompetent secretary.
So did Benny Hill. I mean, come on, the guy's.
Yeah, yeah. So if Pence were president, Pence is a professional politician, Paul Ryan's a professional politician, they'd have a competent press secretary. They'd be, you know, the Republican Party, they'd work with the Republican Party and they'd get the best people. They'd work with their corporate friends and they'd, you know, get the best spokesperson. So they would be efficient and presidents, but you know, their administrations would be competent and run the way most of the others have. But they're still Republicans. And if you're progressive, you would still see them and probably more easily getting policies through that you don't like. So, you know, you can't just, and that's part of the problem of focusing on Trump as a person. It's hard not to. He does take up all the air in the room for the wrong reasons, but focusing so much on him. So half the progressives say, we must get rid of him. We must, you know, we must impeach him. And I think it's also just getting ahead of ourselves. You know, impeachment is a trial. You have to charge someone with something. The House of Representatives acts as a jury, is my understanding of how it works. But it's a charge of some wrongdoing. And at this point, the innuendo is not enough. And speaking of FBI directors, this guy, Robert Mueller, is going to be a special counsel. And I'm going to admit, I'm not too sure how that differs from a special prosecutor. But I think it's worth looking into and just clearing the air and finding out what is and is not true so that, you know, we can stop playing into this soap opera quality of this issue. And I'm also concerned about this Russophobia because it plays into the hands of the hawks, some of whom are Democrats, some of whom are Republicans. And now it's like everything Russian is evil. There's a Time, the Time magazine cover story shows what they said was the Kremlin. It's actually St. Basil's Cathedral. But anyway, taking over the White House. And with no text at all, it's just supposed to be clearly understood that Russia is taking over the United States. And what this and the comments from so-called journalists are pretty appalling. There was a New York Times writer who referred to Cyrillic autocracy, you know, something about Putin said he was going to publish the transcripts of Lavrov's meeting. And I was like, really, dude, you know, Cyrillic autocracy? I you know, so it's just, it's turned into this anti-Russian thing. And it concerns me because that makes it the more you demonize a people, the easier it is to go to war against them and to make the case against them and to do things that are very dangerous.
In Russia, Russian, Russia, Russia, Russian, Russia, 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 of whether or not Russia had help, whether they had confederates inside the Trump campaign when they launched this attack. But every day I leave my show and I think I'm going to be talking about something else. But every day over the course of the news cycle, a new piece of it falls in place. We're about to find out if the new president of our country is going to do what Russia wants. If the presidency is effectively a Russian op, right? If the American presidency right now is the product of collusion between the Russian intelligence services and an American campaign. I mean, that is so profoundly big.
this is not part of American politics. This is not, you know, partisan warfare between Republicans and Democrats. This is international warfare against our country.
I don't think anyone really wants to go to war with Russia. I don't think anyone's that crazy. I think it's mostly for in internal politics that this is being done. But I think it's really dangerous. But that we could end up backing into a conflict.
Sure. I think something that people aren't, for or the proxy war in Syria, for example, that can turn into a hot war. So the proxy war in Ukraine. So all of these places where the Obama administration with Hillary Clinton, you know, making, I mean, speaking of meddling in other countries' affairs, you know, Ukraine had an elected president, and Americans always go on and on about democracy and elections, and the United States took sides in Ukraine's political crisis and helped to overthrow an elected president. Now, what I always ask people is, if Mexico had a crisis and Vladimir Putin took sides and helped to overthrow an elected government right on America's border, that would be a problem for an American president. And I think people need to think about things in that way and see why that's a problem for Putin. And so he reacts by annexing Crimea. And I'm not going to say that's something the Russian government should have done, but it was a result of the United States taking part in something that was a danger to Russia. Or Libya or Syria, all these places where the United States working with Saudi Arabia, I mean, my God, one of the worst countries in the world, who use jihadist forces to do the dirty work. So Libya is destroyed. There's a huge ongoing humanitarian crisis there. Syria is a humanitarian crisis. However bad Assad is, people were not fleeing the country until the Saudis and the Turks and the United States used groups to help to try to overthrow him, which they haven't succeeded in doing. So this country is a ruin, and people are suffering terribly now since 2011. So to paint Russia as the only bad guy, and I find that troubling too. The media don't even go through an effort of even asking for expert opinion. You know, there are people who are Russia experts who, if they say anything, if they say what I just said, for example, about Ukraine, they're just dismissed as Putin apologists, and they don't put them on TV. So you have nobody who knows anything about it explaining these things. People who speak Russian, who've studied the history of the country, studied the history of U.S.-Russian relations, and they are iced out because they don't repeat the party line. And it's very, very troubling.
Do you know who Michael Tracy is? Have you heard of Michael Tracy? I just had him on. I just interviewed him the other day. And his interview may come right before yours, but he is a pretty objective journalist working for TYT, and he says he gets called a Kremlin stooge and a Russian apologist and, you know, all sorts of names by other journalists on Twitter, I guess, all the time.
Yeah, yeah, it's terrible. You can't, if you don't toe the party line, there is this, you know, I don't want to say red baiting since Russia's not communist anymore, but yeah. Russia baiting or something, Russophobia, you know, there are any number of terms.
And you could be
that one
you could
can
be a
use.
Defender of, like, you could stand against the conflict in Iraq, you know, the invasion of Iraq. You could stand up and say that you thought what the United States was doing was wrong during the lead up to the invasion of Iraq without being called, you know, an agent, being told that you're an agent for Saddam. I mean, this is new. I haven't really experienced
it. It is. It's terrible. And I think it's the culmination of years of vilifying Putin as a person. And then Hillary Clinton making Putin an issue in the campaign, using Marco Rubio's opposition research. Frankly, Rubio was going to use that against Trump. She picks up on that. And she uses, she's Putin's puppet, and she uses that against Trump. She escalates this this really terrible Russophobia. So now you have a situation where people just, unless you say the same thing, you are not given a voice. And you, you know, and you have this mysterious, this prop or not, the propaganda or not website, which is a, you know, a child of the Washington Post, and Black Agenda Report ended up on this list of websites which were considered to be, I don't know, useful idiots or stooges of Putin or, you know, whatever.
I've heard a variety of things about what this actually means when they say Trump is Putin's puppet. Like, at first, it just seemed to mean that maybe he had some communication with Russia and knew about some of the things that were going to be leaked to WikiLeaks in advance. That was like one thing that was dropped. But then once he was elected, we had some documents floated that were clearly fraudulent, but that still got pushed around, you know, and reported on, that BuzzFeed reported on them, and then the CNN and the New York Times reported on BuzzFeed reporting on them. It was the piss documents, you know, they're going to black yes, the peeing prostitutes. They've got him some pictures and recordings of prostitutes peeing on him in Moscow, and they're going to use that as blackmail, and so they can control what he does with these, you know, with this black, these documents that they have. That was the other thing that I heard. But was that, does that mean that now they're doing that, or were they, did they help him win the nomination? Did they select him to run? What are we supposed to believe?
I think we're supposed to believe that they helped him win.
With the WikiLeaks, with WikiLeaks and the hacking.
That they hacked the DNC and exposed the DNC emails, which were, to say the least, unflattering of Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party, and that he has taken money from Russians, that his associates have taken money from Russians. And the things they make a big deal out of, apparently one of his sons a few years ago had a conversation with someone about who invested in a Russian, a Trump golf course, and his son said, oh, we get money from Russians. And people said, aha, that's proof. So if some Russian, a rich Russian, invested in a golf course, that's hardly proof of Russian control of the U.S. government. But now, and I think also there's just still this trauma of Trump's victory, that this disbelief that he actually won, and that as a person, he is as bad as we suspected, that he is the person he presented himself to be. And now he can't. I always thought it was odd, because during the campaign, what he said about Russia was, he said, we should have better relations with Russia. Well, that's something Ronald Reagan said. Ronald Reagan went from calling the Soviet Union the evil empire to consummating a historic nuclear agreement with Gorbachev, which drastically cut the number of nukes. And it's generally Republican presidents who do this, by the way. So that was a reasonable thing to say. But Hillary Clinton was, someone wrote a book about her called Queen of Chaos. And so she's a total hawk. And that's what she, you know, I don't know if you recall from the Democratic convention, they were, you know, all these generals and former CIA people were given speaking roles. And so anybody who wasn't a hawk is a traitor.
Now, how does someone like Clinton, how does she come to be such a hawk? I mean, what do you think, what happened to her along the way? Was she always a hawk, or?
Well, I think she's more conservative. I mean, she told a story about being a Goldwater girl, she was raised in a Republican family. I read an article about her once when she was at Wellesley, and the era of the demonstrations against Vietnam War, she always told people not to demonstrate. Bill Clinton is a conservative Democrat. So, you know, these Southern Democrats, actually, at this point, there are hardly any Democrats in the South anymore, any white Democrats in the South. I guess that's how I should put it. But I think she was always a conservative. I think it's her, you know, strange way of proving herself. I don't know. I'm not a mind reader, and I don't always like it when other people pretend to be, you know, psychologists. But for whatever reason, she's firmly there. I think Obama was too, but in his presentation, he wasn't so obvious about it. So she would laugh about getting Muammar Gaddafi killed. And he would know better than to do that, even though he helped to get that done. I think her own personal, you know, flaws, whatever they are, I think she's a true believer. I'll put it that way. I think she's a true believer in imperialism and U.S. Hegemony.
Yeah, well, see, this is the thing that I think is easy to forget, that there was a lot of continuity between the Bush administration and the Obama administration, and that, you know, when we went to war in Afghanistan after 9/11, but even more after when we invaded Iraq, we were doing all this under a doctrine of the new American century. There was a desire to really dominate the globe. And it has seemed, especially since 2008, that role for America is diminishing, that we don't really have the same status or stature that we used to have. And that's just because the economy has been decimated underneath us. I would think that I kind of felt like Obama was moderating away from being the police dog of the world, you know, the policeman of the world. But maybe that was a delusion on my part. Maybe I was missing the boat. I mean, he was, after all, expanding the war and using drones to do it. Do you think there's continuity between the neoconservative agenda under Bush and the kind of center of the Democratic Party, the neoliberal center?
Sure, I think so, definitely. I think the difference, whereas Bush used U.S. troops to invade Iraq, Obama would not do that. He was more shrewd. So they backed these jihadists in Libya and Syria and other places, and watches things go to hell. I mean, that's the real Benghazi scandal that Republicans tried to make so much hay out of. The American ambassador ended up being killed by the people that America used to get rid of Gaddafi. You know, and Republicans were part of that plot too, so they, you know, have no standing to criticize. They were just trying to make political hay. But yeah, there's more continuity than not from president to president. And I you know, now I don't want to give up my activism, but I'm now convinced that the only people who will be allowed to be president are people who promise that continuity. I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of the elites have issues with Trump. He was such a wild card. They didn't know what he was going to do. Whereas Hillary Clinton, you knew what she was going to do. So a lot of those people are after him now, and now he's hamstrung and can't do as much as he wants. That could be a good thing, but it still troubles me, this notion that of people bragging about getting the president. And you know, we have politics in this country. If somebody wins who you don't like, it's your obligation to, yes, to oppose them, but to build your own party or your own forces and try to regain victory and defeat people politically. That's the obligation. And I also find it interesting that Hillary Clinton messed up so badly, but nobody says that. It's interesting. She lost, you know, Wisconsin and Michigan, to a very important states that flipped from and Pennsylvania as well, that flipped from Democrat to Republican. And all she needed was, I think I read 80,000. It's months now. I think I'm safer now using numbers than I was when we talked after Election Day. But anyway, she needed something like 80,000 votes to win those three states. Now, she raised $1 billion how do you have $1 billion? You can't eke out an additional 80,000 votes.
Well, they just didn't go. They didn't go there. They had this MOOC character.
Exactly. She never went. She never went. And I said, what do you mean she never went? She didn't go to those states for months. And they were actually, it's been revealed, and they were depending on volunteers instead of paying people to go door to door. I mean, you know, you'd send people to go door to door because it works. And people need to see you, not just to see TV commercials. But they just tried to cut it too close, and with her own, frankly, unpopularity. That they were completely defensive, and Trump, for all the wrong reasons, Trump did inspire new voters. He got 2 million more votes than Romney did. Now, were the people who switched, were the people who hadn't voted before or hadn't voted in decades? I'm not sure, and I don't know if anybody knows, frankly. But the fact that she and her team did not know she was in trouble is huge. And it says a lot about the Democratic Party and its failings. And, you know, and that's the other reason they're ginning up this Russia stuff, because they don't want people pointing fingers at them, which is what should happen. Democrats should be in open revolt against their party, at the very least demanding, how did this happen? And why? And it's part of a pattern. It's, you know, they lost the House and they lost the Senate, then they lost the state house. The only thing they had left was the presidency, and they lost that. So, but that doesn't seem to come up as a topic of discussion, which I find.
Have you read this book, Shattered?
I have not read it. I've read excerpts of it.
Yeah, I read it, and it's remarkable. The only one, I guess, who had some clue about what was going on was Bill, who I guess is pretty sharp. But and a few others, but Bill Clinton knew. He was saying, you know, we should pay attention to what went on in the UK with Brexit. There's something happening. We shouldn't underestimate this populist surge. I lost friends on the left after the election because I was convinced that as bad as Trump was and as much of a racist, misogynist, proto-fascist threat that he was, that we had to understand him also as an expression of discontentment with the status quo, that this was a populist upsurge, and that energy went to Trump because it had no, it didn't go to Trump, you know, very, very strongly, right? He didn't just have a landslide victory or anything. But he managed to squeak through because there was nowhere else for that energy to go. There was no legitimate political party in the United States that had anything to offer people who were feeling their standard of living was declining, that their options for the future were declining. They were feeling like this just wasn't working for them anymore. And I'm talking about, I guess, mostly white people when I say that, because the Black and Hispanic populations have not felt that there's much of a future for them probably for a long time. But even they didn't turn out the way they normally do.
No, because they weren't being offered anything. And the Democrats know it's not brain surgery to get people to vote for you. You give them what they want. People want a higher minimum wage. And the Democrats could have run on that. They could have, instead of treating Bernie Sanders as an irritant to be gotten rid of, they could have asked themselves, what was this about? What is there one thing that Bernie ran on that we can sort of kind of, okay, he talked about free college. Let's talk about cheap college, or something, anything. And if Bill, and finally, yes, if Bill Clinton gave me election advice, I would take it. But, anyway, they did not. And, you know, with the Black vote, there was this assumption that Obama's support would carry over for Hillary. And it would be like Obama's third term, and he'd go out and speak, and Michelle would go out and speak. And so people who liked Obama would turn out for Hillary Clinton. And in some places, that did not happen. The other thing Democrats should be condemned for not talking about is voter suppression. These voter ID laws and all these efforts by Republicans to hold down the votes of Black people in particular cost her votes and could have cost her the election. But Democrats never talk about that. She doesn't talk about it. She talks about Comey and she talks about the Russians, but she does not talk about the fact that people who would have voted for her were prevented from voting. And I find that interesting, too, that the Democrats want to, you know, again, have it both ways, get black votes, but not stand up for black people. And so the Democrats, they had played this game of threading this needle and had managed to hold on to the White House. And finally, there was a day of reckoning. And as far as Brexit and so forth and Trump's appeal, a friend of mine says there is a, he says, a crisis of legitimacy. He said, and that's why Brexit wins. And that's why more than 60 million people vote for Donald Trump. The system is not working for them. And people's expectations are not being met, that people have kids who, if they do go to college, they graduate with debt and can't have an expectation of finding a full-time job with at a living wage. And these things make people uneasy, and for a good reason.
Yeah, and impeaching Trump is not going to solve any of those things. If that's the thing that I want people to keep in mind is that, yeah, let's say we get a competent President Pence, and he gets legislation through, like the new AHCA or the Trump Care. Well, will that squelch the forces that put Trump into the presidency? I don't think so. Will they be calmer and more likely to vote for the establishment in 2018 or 2020 because Trump got impeached? I don't think so. So the question for me is, like, what do we do, people who are on the left, to develop something for people can put this resentment and this distrust of the establishment, this, you know, earned distrust of the establishment, were somewhere other than into a reality TV show host.
Yeah, I think the problem, the two-party duopoly is the problem. And for progressives, the Democratic Party is the problem. And I think we have to start a new party. And I, you know, their repeated failures, you know, the argument about the lesser of two evils, and you can make this case. We have a system that's hostile to third parties, and you're relegated to being a spoiler. But now the Democrats can't even win. So it isn't even like, you know, it's not even like you have to say that, you know, the current Democratic Congress isn't to your liking. They don't have one. Then we don't have a president in the White House. They gave up the state, you know, and Republicans, you got to give the devil his due. They think long term. They'll lose a presidential election and then say, let's take over the states and gerrymander districts and create safe seats and run circles around the Democrats, who seem to just live in hope that Republicans will be unpopular enough that they can get votes without doing anything. So that's the situation we're in. I think we have to expose the Democrats.
Do you see anything developing somewhere that's a party that you would support?
Unfortunately, I mean, I'm registered as a Green, but I'm concerned that people who call themselves in the resistance, they are in resistance to Trump as an individual more than anything else. And that is a mistake. And I think it would lead to, if Trump were impeached, then as we discussed, we'd have a more efficient Republican administration who could really get right wing policies passed. And so that's where we are right now. The resistance has to be bigger. It has to be a resistance to the system. It has to be a resistance against the Democrats. From not just their incompetence, but, you know, Trump talked about things that, actually in some way we're to the left of Democrats. Now, his point of view is not the same. His politics aren't mine. But these trade deals, NAFTA and TPP, have been a disaster for working people. His appeal is, I don't think it's correct to call him a populist. I think he is a nationalist. And in America, that means white people. But in talking about, you know, Democrats helped create these things too, so they weren't going to talk about them. He's not going to be able to bring back manufacturing jobs. That ship sailed. But the fact that he talked about it at all, I think, got him a lot of votes. When he said, I'm going to make this a workers' party, I said, why is Donald Trump the one saying that and not Hillary Clinton?
You know, you say that nationalism is, it means white people, but I think there were some who, and I've heard like that there was polling done and things that like, even amongst Hispanics, there's a sense that they want to control the borders as long as they're not actually, you know, naturalized citizens. And that amongst black people, there was a sense that, yeah, we'd like to have more jobs and we don't want to have to compete with immigrants. That you can actually play a nationalist angle across racial and ethnic lines in this country because we are, but I don't think he did. But I think that...
No, he did not. I think, you know, Make America Great Again, it was something that, you know, black people...
Yeah, right.
Just it had a visceral, you know, fear of. It was like, we knew this was not a good thing for us. It's like, if you are hearkening back to the past, usually means something bad for us. But you're right. I think, you know, and Trump presents an issue with immigration. Immigration presents problems. But the only people who talk about it are, you know, Fox News personalities calling people illegals. Then the issue is driven underground. It's when it needs to be brought to light and debated. Do immigrants take jobs from Americans? Are they driving down wages? It's something to discuss and to question. No, we don't need a wall at the border with Mexico. But I think this is something that, that speaking of black people, we discuss amongst ourselves. Is all this immigration good for us? And many people believe, and I think with some legitimacy, that it is not. But the Democratic Party, they just hope to get new voters, so they're not going to question any of it. And the Republicans, they just, you know, their appeal is just, strictly racist. So, but it's something that needs to be discussed. And that's also why I think there's a crisis of legitimacy. I think the biggest reason for the crisis of legitimacy is that capitalism is under great pressure. And that has meant, especially in a country where we're told there's no other option, people are doing badly. I remember during the 2012 campaign and, Mitt Romney made comments about the 47% of Americans who receive some sort of government benefits and people said he was insulting veterans and so forth. But I was just astounded at that number. That is nearly half of the population. And about a year ago, there was a statistic that the median income is 30,000, not the median income, but at any rate, there's some Americans, half of all Americans are poor. But it's not something any and people who aren't poor are afraid of ending up that way, of watching their options dwindle and they're, you know, knowing they may have job security, but the, you know, generations coming behind them don't. So if somebody comes forward talking about something new, that person is going to get attention and is going to get support. I think that's what happened with Brexit. You had the elite saying, well, isn't the EU wonderful? But low-wage workers from some of the poorer European countries coming into London at the same time that the British government was practicing this very strict austerity and taking away from people, that led to the Brexit result. So it bears paying attention to, and I think it's so funny with Trump. If you say anything, I know what you mean about losing friends. It's like you have to preface every statement with, I don't like Trump, but, you know, I understand why he got votes, or I don't like Trump, but, you know, he had a good point about Russia. So he is such a divisive figure that it's almost impossible to speak rationally about him and about the phenomenon that brought him to the White House.
Do you think that the left, you know, our kind of progressive to Marxist left, was better off, had a clearer direction, understood what its role was better when Obama was president than we do now? Or has this energized the left?
Well, I think Obama really crushed the left because ultimately most of us just get behind the Democratic Party and we just breathe a sigh of relief that the Republicans are not in office anymore. So people who protested Bush's invasion of Iraq were quiet when Obama expanded these wars in other ways with the proxy wars and so forth, and just stood down and were de-energized by him. And so we went from being de-energized to being sort of energized, but not in the right way, and being energized about this in particular individual and not about the system, and now not about the fundamental things that need to change. So that's the dilemma that we have.
Yeah, but the thing is, I agree with you when it comes to the anti-war movement, because I was involved in that during the Bush administration, Bush Jr., and it definitely dismantled itself when Obama was elected. In fact, it dismantled itself when the Democrats took the Congress. It was before Obama. And so that's absolutely true. But the character of the anti-war movement in this country has always been upper class. The people who are out in the streets for the most part are, urban liberals, white liberals for the most part. But what we saw under Obama was, Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter. These movements that weren't coming from the same quarters as, these weren't boomers or, who were replaying the Vietnam era. These were people who were struggling for themselves about issues that were directly impacting them. Wasn't a charitable act to try to prove to history that we don't like killing people. It was, this can't stand. You're ruining our lives. The Wall Street has to go. The cops have to be stopped. And I felt like I felt like there was some energy on the left, especially around 2011 to 2014 or so.
Well, I think that's when the bloom was off the rose with Obama.
Yeah.
And frankly, there was, Occupy was, there was so much, there was a lot of hope with Obama. People did think things were going to change, and they did not get, I think it's so funny that if you criticized Obama, what was the first thing people said? Obamacare, and it's like, yeah, but what about Obamacare? Which is now could potentially be dismantled. But anyway, that's the irony of that. But aside from that, people did not see the changes they wanted to see. And so Occupy ultimately failed. It was bought off by nonprofits and big NGOs partly, and, partly just crushed. The police came in and just dismantled it. Black Lives Matter was not, as an organization, I criticized them for not being political enough. So you capture this anger. Well, then what do you do? Do you make a political demand? Do you
try to get some nice jobs out of it? It pretty much is what both organizations
did. Well, that's the danger. Yeah. That's always the danger in this country. Because that's what, it's one of the things that ended the liberation movement of the 60s and early 70s. The system said, okay, we're going to let some black people in, and that'll, we can let off some of the steam that way.
We'll let in some radicals. That's always been. I mean, they did that after 68. I forget the guy's name, but he ended up in the parliament, the leader of the strikes in 68. They do that. They absorb the leaders of radical movements right back into the system. It happens.
Right. Yeah. Yes, it's effective. That's why it keeps happening.
That's right. So really the truth is it's six to one, half dozen the other as far as which kind of bourgeois president you have as far as energizing the left. If we have someone like Trump, we get energized against him. Against the Republicans, maybe,
right.
If we're doing really well. But right now, it's not even against all Republicans that effectively. It's mostly just against Trump. And if we have a Democrat, then we get demobilized, and it takes. And then I guess when we do organize ourselves, it expresses itself in ways that are incoherent, that don't lead anywhere.
Yeah, I think, but you mentioned Occupy and Black Lives Matter. We have to examine how those movements took off and how they could have been sustained. I think ultimately there's a bigger problem than most people realize as this crisis of legitimacy. And we need something really revolutionary, not, you know, Bernie Sanders marketing of a revolution, but something truly revolutionary in this country. And we have to give up this, you know, dependence on electoral politics. And we have a lot to talk about and a lot to hash out and figure out how to do that. It's not going to be easy, but I think we, at the very least, we know what does not work. We know what has not worked. And we know what has failed, and you can, you know, that's a good starting point for moving forward.
Well, that's great. Is there anything, I always ask you this, and we've talked for an hour now, so is there anything I should have asked you about that I didn't, that you want to say something about?
Well, we pretty much, you know, talked about everything, practically everything in the news. We have covered just about, we've covered everything, but I'm very much concerned about corporate media propaganda. There are three stories this week that it was like propaganda overdrive. It was I believe, the fake story of Trump giving a non-secret to the Russians. This hacking attack that happened all over the world with the ransomware. So someone decides the North Koreans did it, which I don't believe. And then there was a story about President Assad and Syria using crematoria to get rid of dead bodies. And I found it interesting they use the word crematoria because that makes them sound like Hitler. And this proxy war has the potential of being extremely dangerous. So I feel like the corporate media represents us less and less and is worse and worse for the quality of the journalism itself and their biases. And their mission of upholding the status quo is going to do us all in. So that's what I've been thinking about lately.